virus, go to work. Sit in the sun, stay alert. Control the virus, go to work. Sit in the sun, stay alert. Control the virus, go to work. Sit in the sun, stay alert. We have a route and we have a plan. Work from home if you can.
Hello and welcome to episode 1 of season 2 of Sicko Mode. I'm Siang.
The Venga Boys are back in town.
And the Venga Boys are back in town.
I'm Joe. And Hello. We're back.
Yeah. Good times. Why are we back?
Well, it looks like a job for us, looking at everything that's happening.
Everything that is happening. So, how long has it been since we last did one?
3 aeons. No, I don't know.
Several months, at least.
Yeah, we took a break for the summer. Yeah. We had a hot summer.
It was a hot summer that we always knew was going to come to a grisly and disastrous end.
Did we? I mean,
in terms of the corona, brief window where after they've relaxed all the measures and then they're like, everyone go to the pub, go to the restaurant, have a great time. We all knew that something was going to happen, and that something was...
Oh, don't spoil it.
Spoiler alert.
So why are we recording today? We're currently trapped in the top room of the lighthouse that I live in because Siang came around for a sleepover and then... There was a virus outbreak, just like in the board game pandemic.
Yeah.
And now we've been isolated for 3 days? 4 days?
It's like day 3.
Is it? Okay.
Well, I came over on Tuesday.
Okay, yeah, of course, day 3. So we're hanging out, and so we decided that it's time to drop season 2.
Yes.
Of Sicko Mode. And for a long time we were planning like what great interviews we might have, the kind of research we might do. We might be very kind of evidence-based, research-led, materialist. And then we thought, actually, let's just not prepare anything.
Let's be true to ourselves.
Yeah.
And
raw intelligence.
Raw intelligence and the manic energy of being in the same room 24/7.
Oh yeah. It's just like episode 1 of season 1.
Yeah.
Was when it was just the week before lockdown, mm-hmm. and you and I were together in the same room.
Yeah.
And we never have been since to record, I mean.
No, because we did some interviews when we were
living in the same house.
But
yes.
Because of the way that we recorded, we had to like...
I'd go to my room in the attic, and you'd go to your room in the basement.
Yeah.
And we'd communicate by banging on the pipe that runs from the basement to the attic.
Well, we communicated because...
Banging on it with a wrench.
Joe's room was right above my room, and I could hear literally every move that he made.
Wafer thin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wafer thin. Which you requested that I live there, because you wanted to keep an eye on me.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm here today.
Good, yeah, vigilance.
But, no, Joe's graciously been allowing me to stay in his room.
It's been great.
That's good.
Yeah, I wish you make it a permanent arrangement. We'd save on rent.
I'm not sure about that. You were sleeping on the floor.
It's true. And we keep bumping into each other.
Yes.
It's not gigantic here.
It's not
at the top of the lighthouse.
You also have a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's true. I have a lot of things.
But anyway, that's what's going on here.
Yeah.
So.
What's going on in the world, though? That's what this is all about, right?
What's going on in the world is... Are we allowed to, you know, do spoilers now?
Yeah, we can do spoilers now.
What's going on in the world is that... Well, at least what's going on in the UK is that the second wave is here. Very much here.
I'm going to pour tea. Is that okay?
That's okay.
Okay. Keep talking.
Yeah. It's very... It's like lifelike, you know. Like, you're really dripping on the floor. Anyway.
Yeah.
Second wave is here. Was it yesterday that was the highest number of new cases recorded in a day in the UK? That was the case.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I was always like, when did the first wave end, you know? I'm one of those slightly contrary. Like, people keep asking me, oh, we're going to have a second lockdown? And I flick down my Ray-Bans over my nose and I go, tell me, did the first lockdown ever end? Am I right?
And also, it's kind of, well, it's pretty obvious that they did the semi-full lockdown for a bit and then they decided that, you know, the economy, the capitalist death drive, it needs to continue. So if people are thinking about a second lockdown, I don't think that a second lockdown similar to what we had before is going to happen again.
No, I
think... Schools will be open.
Yeah.
People still be working. Furlough is not coming back, as we know.
They've gotten people used to the idea of the daily death.
People dying all the time.
Yeah, so they're, yeah. But you know, but they're not completely used to it. And also the hospital system would buckle if they just went like full Sweden or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would be surprised if it was as stringent as the first lockdown was.
But what they're doing instead is basically you can do anything that you have to pay for.
Yeah, it'll be, socially it will be as stringent, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But I imagine they'll just keep businesses going. But businesses, I mean, those businesses surely will buckle. I mean, I thought that small businesses were already done for.
Mm.
But they seem to have been kept alive by eat out to help out.
Yeah.
And the kind of bonfire
which
of,
I think in some places are still going. Well, like, not the government one, but in some places, like, Franco Mica in Cambridge is still doing eat out to help out, but like a different version. That's
people
like
have their own version.
But obviously, I'm not going to eat out to help out in the near future because I'm scared.
I never did. Yeah. I hate being sensible with money. It wasn't even an ideological thing. I went to the only restaurant I ever went to, Cafe Blue Sage, didn't actually have eat out to help out.
You love to make bad choices.
That's true. But to return to that second wave question, to be completely serious, there was obviously always, there was just still corona around in the UK. It wasn't like Vietnam or, you know, Korea or China. Yeah, many other places that actually just got it pretty much under control. And they counted a second outbreak as like a few cases, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in the UK, it's just always been kicking about.
Remember in China?
Hanging around.
There was like, there was like 11 new cases or something. So they tested like millions of people.
Right.
Obviously, you know, the approach in the UK is not the same.
No.
And in the UK, especially, the way that it's happening is, I feel like, it's pretty clear that it will be socially stringent. You'll have to go to work, you'll have to go to school, you'll have to go to university, fuck that. But they will very much then turn around and say, as Matt Hancock basically said, when there's a second wave, as we all know there's going to be, it's all your fault.
Wow, yeah. I mean, there's many people on my list, that, you know, my list of people that I would redacted if I ever had redacted. But Matt Hancock is definitely on that list. He makes me absolutely livid. Yeah. I mean, listeners, you know, if you get mad, you lose. Don't let your enemies make you mad. But I mean, you know, he does.
I lose every day.
It's true.
I'm mad 24/7.
Permanently enraged.
Permanently enraged.
We're not the Venger boys, but the Venge boys.
The Venge boys.
Venge is short for revenge.
Yes, in case you didn't know.
With the Venge bots. But maybe we should talk about university in a bit.
Yeah.
And what that is going to look like. But let's take a step back.
Mm-hmm.
And think about, where did we come from? Because let's think about a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was saying, you know, let's open a few things back up. Life is good. We're going to have a test, track and trace system in place.
Mm-hmm.
Except, of course, all the unions and pretty much everyone we knew was saying that that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
They've given $500 million to McDonald's and Ronald McDonald has spent it on a giant T-shirt cannon. And the T-shirts say corona free.
It was stolen by the Hamburglar.
Yeah, it was all lucrative contracts were stolen by the Hamburglar, who has been employed by Serco to rob it all.
Yeah.
But basically, we always knew that we were going to end up in this position. I mean, weirdly, we did actually know the whole time, didn't we?
Yeah,
everyone's
did.
Like, shock, horror. I can't believe that we've ended up in this position.
Yeah.
That, you know, certain swathes of the commentary, I might have ignored that.
Yeah.
But there were people who were saying this. There were even some journalists who were always maintaining that, well, how could this possibly work?
As we know now more than ever, whenever we are cynical or pessimistic, it's always correct.
Almost always. I mean, I have been at points in the early days of this podcast said that I soon expect us to be under martial law and that tanks would be on the streets. Now,
I mean,
it turned out that was a slight exaggeration.
That was a slight exaggeration, but the approach is not that dissimilar.
Yeah.
It's just more Imperial Corps rather than, you know, the periphery. In the Imperial Corps, they're unlikely
true.
To bring out the tanks as yet, but they are, you know, empowering the police ever more every day. Was it like they were saying that they would give you a £10,000 fine if you were found to be violating self-isolation.
Yeah, so. They break your legs and confiscate your money and send it to the Queen to shore up her estates. It's a Henry VIII kind of Reformation type deal.
Yeah.
You get battered and they give the money to Prince Andrew so that he can go watch the golf on the big TV.
Yeah. Well, obviously, as we know, to people who are wealthier, a large fine is just a large fine. To people who are not that wealthy and cannot pay the fine becomes, you know, going to prison.
Yeah, that's the end of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, COVID prison as well.
Yeah. So, that kind of thing.
Actually, did you see the pictures of the COVID marshals going around Soho last night?
No.
So, I think it was the volunteer COVID marshals were going around. The volunteer
COVID marshals.
I might be wrong about that.
So, nation is a nation of narcs. Yeah. We're all the police in our soul.
It's curtain twitching is in the genetics.
Yeah.
But they were going around looking for lock-ins in Soho. To see, they were like knocking on doors going like, you better not be having a party in there.
What were they going to do if they were having a party?
You know, I don't know. Probably arrange for them to be fined or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, but wait, we don't really, let's stay on track. We're talking about where we've come from. This is what happens. We didn't make a plan. We just decided to burst right into it.
Now we're like, just staring each other in the eye.
It's true. It's very intimate.
Yeah.
But we've just burst into this podcast like Danny DeVito bursting out of a sofa.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now we need
it's been too long for us to go back into the sofa.
Exactly. You can't go in. The toothpaste has been squeezed out of the tube.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but so the position we're in now is just a continuation of the original position we were in when we started, really, in terms of the pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of people have been saying online that it's constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, you know, when will my job finally kind of, will it wrap up? Will I end up on universal credit? Yeah. Obviously, all of the measures been announced are completely...
inadequate.
Even more than unsatisfactory, just a complete joke, basically. Yeah. And, you know, obviously the system can't sustain this level of kleptocracy and stupidity kind of all, and the chaos and confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and so maybe we could think about the university as a kind of case study in point.
Maybe we could.
Yeah, we could. And you're now intimately involved with the university.
I am a redacted, redacted.
Yeah,
And
you're speaking here in a personal capacity.
I'm speaking here in a purely personal capacity. Let's pretend I never said my name. You don't know who I am or where I am.
Take up a pseudonym. Like, I'm Joey Rizzo now.
I'm Margaret.
Okay, thanks, Margaret.
As I like to tell people, my mum was also almost going to call me Margaret after the great Margaret Thatcher.
Nice, solid.
So.
Iron.
It's me, Peggy, the Iron Lady.
Patriotic, okay.
But I currently work in a student representative capacity at an institution.
Keep them guessing.
I think about the coronavirus and more specifically, the return to university on a daily basis, even at the weekend, unfortunately, because I love to just think about work all the time. And I have to say that it is one of the most depressing experiences of my life, mainly because we as student representatives and also basically anyone who is paying any attention, academics who work at universities, anyone who, on the outside, who thought about it for a bit, have been saying from, you know, the start, 3 months ago when I started my job and also before then, that it would be an incredibly stupid idea for students to all go back physically to campus. And during these months, it's been like, you know, well, currently the infection rate's kind of low here, so it will be fine. Well, like, we're gonna put in these measures, you know, we're like, what if there's a second wave or, you know, a continuation of the original wave? Yeah. What if coronavirus is not under control and institutions have kind of refused to entertain the notion despite the fact that it was plainly obvious it was going to happen? And at this point, it is very clear that what is driving these decisions is the marketization of higher education and all the individual institutions' kind of competition with each other and commitment to their own like financial health. And because at the end of the day, what they want from students returning is their tuition fees and their rent money.
They've got dollar bill signs in their eyes, exactly. And on their tongue, and they're sticking their tongue out.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's very ugly. And it's so disgusting. But also, I feel like many of these people who work, you know, higher up in universities, either they're just lying to themselves or they genuinely can't see reality anymore.
Yeah, it's a bit like false consciousness, isn't it? But for the bourgeoisie, which I wonder, all of these people in positions of influence, and they might as individuals say, oh, I don't have that much say over that, I don't have that much say over this. But there's all these high-ranking people in the university and also in other institutions or even at state level who seem to have completely abnegated any responsibility to making things better whatsoever.
Yeah.
And say, oh no, we just need to appease the machine. The machine calls for blood. We must sacrifice each generation anew to the machine.
With the government, it's like, these people are dedicated to capitalism and the continuation of their own class, which is, you know, it's understandable.
Yeah,
it's
evil, signed up.
It's understandable. And that is also why, you know, the way that it has been handled has been so much worse in, like, OECD countries than basically anywhere else, because these countries and their governments are the ones that are most deeply committed to, like, capitalism and the current world order, because that's the one that benefits them, even as it kills their entire populations. Whereas with universities, like, these people, like, at the very least, at the baseline, cynically, they are motivated by, like, continuing to have their own position and, like, financial security for the institution because of marketization. But I feel like at this point it's just kind of staring us all in the face that there is actually no way for this situation to continue and for things to be okay on the other side. Like, what you will have after that is not something that I would consider a success to have maintained.
No, even for them, you wonder if they would really find it, would they really reflect back and think it was worth salvaging in 5 years? Do they really think, you know, just to keep the money coffers being filled up with student rents or whatever?
Yeah.
You know, in this example, it's student rents, but you could apply this in so many other situations. Will they look back in 5 years and think, oh, I'm glad I made that series of decisions to keep participating in that way of tackling this?
Yeah.
It seems, I'd be surprised if they are.
It seems to be like short-termism in the extreme. Like, the actual lack of foresight that has been on display is bizarre. Like, bizarre to the extent that it like must be deliberate. But it's very interesting because all these, you know, managers, they stay in their jobs for 20 years and students and staff leave, you know, like, more often than that. And the way that they always talk about, like, you know, student activism or, like, staff, like, trying to fight for better conditions is that they have the long-term health of the institution in mind, and the students and their staff are just, like, throwing their toys at the pram. They don't have, like, a whole institution picture. Like, they're not thinking about longevity. But I feel like it's kind of the opposite is true. Like, we're all thinking about, like, Jesus fucking Christ, like, in 1 year, in 2 years, in 5 years, like, what will there be in higher education? Like, I don't know. Whereas these people seem to be just thinking, oh, as long as we, like, you know, get the budget right this year, then it'll all be fine. It's not happening.
You just have to make this spreadsheet work out. If we just balance it out. Whereas everyone on the ground is having a kind of collective Cassandra effect.
Yeah.
Just freaking out because we can see that there's no real way to patch this up.
I think
it's interesting what you identify, that the similarity between why so many rich countries in the OECD struggling and why so many countries in the impoverished and, you know, the regions intentionally destabilized by the American Empire and the majority world, why are some of them dealing with this so much better, even though they have considerably less resources?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really make any sense. But if you think about it, how kind of, like, it's like the decadence of the empire that we're in, literally it can't solve its own problems anymore. As our good friend Vijay came on and said, not too long ago, Vijay Prashad said that in an interview to us, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, there's actually an inability for these people to do anything but satisfy the most short-term needs.
Yeah.
And I think can't think about it.
It's interesting to think about, like, when we're like, oh, these countries are the richest countries in the world, like, in one sense, you know, they are the imperial core, they, like, you know, whatever. On the other hand, all this wealth is in the hands of the private, you know, the bourgeoisie, is in the hands of the ruling, whatever, you know, the ruling class. It is not ever to be put at the disposal of the public good. Whereas for a lot of other countries, if you take the example of China,
I thought you might take that example.
If you take the example of China, you know, the ways that resources have been deployed is unimaginable in the UK or in the US. Like, yes, you like know, like, there are individual people who are wealthy. There are huge companies that are incredibly wealthy who are here. Like, all the people in the White House, the absolute decadence. Like, the geographic inequality is insane. But if you actually think about what are the resources that could be used by any government, well, any government you could realistically have to be put at the disposal of stopping something like a pandemic, is tiny, is inadequate.
It's quite stark, the contrast. Yeah. And I saw Green New Deal campaigners criticising President Xi's pronouncements this week about, you know, carbon neutral targets stuff like this.
Yeah.
But I mean, I thought, you know, I mean, I'm maybe more ambivalent or a little bit critical, depending on who I'm talking to. Yeah. About you know, China and the and geopolitics and the American Empire. But I do think it's quite, yeah, that contrast is so stark, because the kind of stuff that Green New Deal were demanding, the kind of state intervention or state capacity or spending, mm-hmm. or just the sheer effort of monopolizing that much power to do something intentional rather than just kind of being part of the economic engine of capital.
It's just not possible.
I mean, it just, you know, it seems much further away here than it does in China, where they have made such efforts to deal with the pandemic recently as compared to the US or the UK.
Yeah. Well, obviously, like, when we think about, like, imperialism more broadly, like, in one sense, yeah, it is, you know, it's, like, the US empire and, like, there's, like, it's, like, geographic and, like, there's countries, there's, like, the imperial core and countries in the periphery, but also it is about the ruling class who are, you know, based in, operate from part of the US imperial core, who are attempting to enclose, privatize the resources, the, you know, the whatever resources, like, financially, like, in terms of people, in terms of natural resources, that other countries have managed to build up and maintain against the forces of US imperialism. Mm. Yeah.
And it's quite interesting how we were talking about the university as a case study, mm-hmm. and what we might term bourgeois false consciousness, or more simply the ability of rich people to trick themselves into thinking they're doing something for different reasons than they're actually doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least to have two states of mind about something they're doing. To be aware what they're doing is bad, but at the same time to keep doing it because they also have a fake good reason, you know. But we've slipped right into talking about the kind of global relations that shape this context to begin with. But it's appropriate, because especially with the university you may or may not work alongside, it's entirely relevant. Yeah. Like, we really are kind of actively shaped by those forces. It's less and less becoming a kind of suave, in obvious soft power, and more like you're getting diktats straight from government about what you do and don't do, mm-hmm. and you have to, when they say jump, you ask how high, and then you kind of make the best economically, you know.
And I think, like,
wait, I'm gonna pour some more tea. I've got this delicious ginger lemon tea. Do you want some? It's keeping me healthy.
I'm all right, thank you. I don't know if it is keeping you healthy.
It's keeping me healthy.
We hope it's keeping you healthy.
We hope. I have, listeners might hear, I have a slight cough. We don't think it's anything.
Yeah.
We really hope it's nothing.
I have a minor cough, but I always have a minor cough, as you may have caught in previous poorly edited episodes of Sicko Mode.
That's the secret of Sicko Mode, that we record it 2 hours for every hour that we put out, because an hour is just coughing.
It's just me coughing.
And we edit it all out. Painstakingly, like going through grains of sand.
Yeah.
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 But, you know, that's the love and attention we pay to the podcast.
But in terms of, like, the university and the global picture, I think it was particularly interesting to... Sorry, just a little bit. I think it's particularly interesting to think about international students.
Yes.
Who, for a very long time, have been basically, well, they are, like, cash cows for UK universities because it's very difficult slash impossible for universities to sustain themselves on the, like, tuition fee model in the UK. Like, they're always claiming that they spend more money on teaching than their tuition fee is. And I don't know if that is true or not, but regardless...
They certainly are forced to chase other avenues of finance and, and profit, right?
Regardless, international fee, tuition fee income has always been a huge source of income. International students and postgraduate students for universities. And whenever, you know, whenever a university says, we're launching a new international strategy, or we're going to launch some new taught postgraduate courses, they're looking at their purses. But international students have, for a long time, been, I guess, thought of as less politically involved, or sometimes have been less politically involved, at least on my campus and some similar campuses. And that is usually, often, also because of the restrictions that the visa system places on them. It's a much more precarious position.
They can't do shit.
They can't do shit.
And then there's a class character as well, but you know, it's it obviously it's overdetermined.
But this year, some universities have decided to charter flights, like just hire planes to fly students from China to the UK to go to university, and literally like trying to negotiate with like the authorities in China, who are like, why are you trying to have more air travel? To be like, can you please let us have this plane so we can bring students here? You know, like my crops are dying.
Please, my family's starving.
My family's starving. And I think that, you know, when these universities like give their own justifications for what they think, for what they're doing, so you know, it's all about the student experience. It's about the community. It's about keeping each other safe. It's like looking out for each other. If you just think about the situation that they've put international students especially into, but also just students in general. Like, if you don't come here, pay like £3,000 for your flight, pay for your fees, pay for your accommodation, get locked in your accommodation probably for like most of the year, never see anyone, have all your teaching online, but you're not allowed to study remotely, and unless you do that, you're gonna have to drop out.
Yeah, no sex, no fun, no friends, no family, just being locked in a room and possibly evicted anytime they feel like.
Just that's... travel from a country where there's like one new case per day to the UK. It will be fine, it will be great. I don't know why you wouldn't want to do that.
So if the university has this international strategy, we need one of our own.
Yeah.
I.e. Maoist third world.
The internationalist strategy.
Yeah. And then we just need to redact it, the redacted. And once the vice chancellors are taken care of, because we've redacted them, then we'll be fine.
It'll all be good.
I mean, so what we should actually say, what do you think the, what's the next phase of the struggle? Because suddenly all of these students are going to be back in halls. They're going to be locked up. Some people are saying there should be red strikes organised. They never should have been forced to come back.
Yeah.
Some saying students should get involved with ACORN. Some saying they should be liaising with their student unions and their NUS.
Yeah.
You know, some saying UCU and the students should, you know, find opportunities to collaborate and kind of a new militant.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these are all things that we like, obviously. But what do we think is most likely to come out of this? I mean, you've been working with students.
At Redacted.
At Redacted.
I think it depends on the situation. For some places, it's too late for students not to go because they're already there.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing now is like outbreaks and students, like 600 students having to self-isolate and being told not to go outside for the entire year. And for those students, I mean, I don't fucking know like what they should do. Like, get involved with your students union, I guess. Like,
yeah,
go on a rent strike maybe, but a lot of it depends on your contract as well. And
yeah, that could be wildcat stuff, you know. If there's certain legal things in place that prohibit some forms of organising, often new things might grow.
Yeah.
But I mean, the UK is not an especially militant place. If anyone ever grows a backbone and has a riot or a left parliamentary project, they get immediately quashed and all of their dreams.
This is the time to have a backbone.
It is.
This is the time to have a backbone.
Yeah.
And talking about universities is sometimes it's useful because now at this point, you know, since, you know, Tony Blair, education, let's get everyone to go to university, the percentage of young people that go to university is like a relatively large segment.
Yeah,
of
it's still
that,
high.
Of that age population.
They're trying to kill it, but it's still high.
It's still high. And also a lot of the students who will be put in these bad positions will be like, you know, students of the ruling class, children of the ruling class.
Yeah. I mean, they'll be in their own houses, but...
Maybe that's... Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Either way. You know, I don't know. It's a lot of people put into the same position in the same place who are in close proximity to each other. And obviously they aren't supposed to see or touch each other. But that has usually been a good breeding ground for some kind of collective or militant action.
It could be. Mm. But we should never forget that there are no shortcuts and we can't suddenly expect some amazing, incredible student movement to spring out of anywhere.
No.
But certainly there's stuff there that might grow into something and people will be organising on the ground about this. And we ourselves are going to be organising on the ground about
this.
That's
an unnamed location.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of already have. Actually, in terms of education, maybe... I could talk a little bit about what's been happening in schools.
You can.
Because obviously schools have been back for a few weeks now. And, you know, I was one of the people that was never convinced that my union, the National Education Union, should even have said that they should return. But they always said, you know, as long as the government gets the test track and trace system in place, it could be okay.
Wait, wasn't that like yesterday? They got the app.
Oh yeah, the app is here.
The app is shit.
Yeah, about 10% of people in the country have it and it's shit, as expected.
We can talk about the update.
And it's late. Okay, sure. But basically, you know, they tried to... I think everyone was just exhausted and they saw that we didn't have the kind of power we needed to completely, like, have a showdown with the government.
Yeah.
And so they kind of said, let's go back and, you know, we'll see what happens. We'll do our best. And it's basically been chaos, just... Lots and lots and lots and lots of sick teachers. Some of them have COVID, some of them don't. It's very hard for anyone to find out. You know, there's no lab capacity like in other countries. Even in somewhere extremely close like Germany, they can do tests like for passers-by and get the results back much, much quicker. Here, I've had... I've known teachers. I won't say who they are, but I've known a couple of teachers who've needed tests and it's taken ages to get them, ages to get the results. Like, they might be losing a whole week of teaching, you know.
Yeah.
And there's not much of a system in place. They just tell the kids, oh, they're off for X or Y reason. They don't say the truth. And then there's supply has to come in. Supply's taking it around from school to school.
Yeah.
You know, it's complete chaos. Like about 3 or 4 months ago, they could have put a huge amount of money into blended learning, digital learning. And, you know, rolled out computers to people. And they really could have made it so actually... you know, you could go quite far on a kind of rota system for schools or some other kind of mixed form. Obviously, the childcare is quite important for a lot of the people working. But there could have been a much better, more balanced, holistic way to do this. But it was just kind of like, all in, okay. Yeah. Maintain distancing, that lasted for about half a day because obviously it's completely impossible. Extra spaces weren't really requisitioned. Extra teachers weren't really hired. You know, all of the stuff that should have happened did not happen if they wanted it to continue. And soon it will kind of, well, it's already kind of collapsing under its own contradictions.
I mean, this is kind of like a similar thing with higher education. Is like, there are things that universities and the government could have done. They just didn't even think of trying to, you know, adapt a new system that worked in this situation. It was just like, well, we're going to try and just have it as close to how it usually is as possible, but everyone's going to stay far away from each other. And, you know, it doesn't fucking work, obviously. But the sheer lack of imagination and inability to even entertain trying to put a system into place that would work, that would have some new elements, that would innovate even a little bit, it's pathetic. And it's tragic.
Yeah. And we kind of, yet again, it's a thing that everyone kind of knew. It's like that, what's that Pasolini essay that we were talking about a while ago?
I don't remember. No.
He just says over and over again, like, we know, like, we all know. Yeah. We know who the fascists are who are planting bombs and blaming it on the left in the years of Lead in Italy in the 70s. Like, we all know.
You remember very specifically, in fact.
I might be wrong on the details. I read this a while ago. But, you know, it's like, we everybody knows. Everybody's in on it. And, like, I think it comes back to the much vaunted and then denied herd immunity strategy.
Yeah.
And we're really just back to herd immunity light. Yeah. It's just everybody get it and deal with it. And that's just how it's going to be.
It's herd immunity, but we're not acknowledging that it's herd immunity. And when people get it, it's individual people's fault.
Yeah, they've successfully convinced much of the public that it's everyone's fault.
As you said from the start, this is the plan. It was always the plan.
Yeah, exactly. We all knew. But, you know, they've got so many of the official press organs hammering out different and confusing messages.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I guess I get a case in point about how completely contradictory and bizarre the whole thing is would be the hilarious slew of articles, what, about a month ago? From lots of Times correspondents saying, you know, I love the office.
I miss
working in the office. The smell of instant coffee in the morning. Jesus. The press of hot bodies on the tube. You know, there was all of this client journalism saying pivot. How good the office was. Yeah, and even in The Guardian, there was some journalists being like, I haven't been in the office in 30 years, but goddamn, do I miss the banter of the office. I would kill to be back in the office. So this massive push, obviously people from the government comms were saying, you know, if you want access to us, please share something about how good it is to be back in the office.
Yeah.
Many of our donors own offices. And then lo and behold, now they're saying everyone get out the office.
Yeah.
It's barely been the blink of an eye. And they're telling everyone to stay home again.
Yeah.
And it's just even by their own standards, surely it's incredibly stupid and short sighted. Like, but I guess just no one really has any final control of it.
Yeah.
And it's literally just kind of the interests of capital. Yeah. Like literal people like Alan Sugar and whatever that just own lots of office blocks. You know, they're not even a functioning part of the kind of capitalist coalition. They don't really do anything socially useful.
Yeah.
They just kind of throw their weight around and demand payment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's and same with the university, right? It all comes back to rent seeking.
To rent seeking, yeah.
That was another thing you and I said months ago. We said,
yeah.
Why is the university demanding that they all come back? Like, they could just do digital learning. Surely they might save some money that way. But obviously they want all those delicious rents.
All the delicious rents.
They're thinking about those rents.
Those rents.
So they've got to get them in.
You could say it's short-sighted. On the part of some people, maybe it is short-sighted. But it is also not, because being short-sighted would imply that they were trying to do the right thing. They just couldn't anticipate the consequences. Whereas, obviously, what is actually the case is that they probably can't anticipate the consequences. They're just in deep denial because they are committed to the delicious, delicious rent.
That is true. I'm being liberal in my interpretation of their motives again. If you just think about it as they just want to get the best profits for their particular business in this particular quarter, then it all makes sense.
Also, on a very minor point, if you work in an office and you, without reservation, love the banter, it's definitely because you're the manager. And all of the people that you manage are, like, participating in this banter with you because it's really awkward to be like, shut up to your manager. But I promise you, all the people that you manage think that you're annoying and that it's very weird that you're trying to be friends with them all the time.
Ooh, this feels like a poison pen letter to an ex-employer.
I will
no comment.
Say nothing.
If you speak, you're in big trouble. But it's not all doom and gloom. Like,
no.
They say that every trade union speech at a rally should end on a note of hope and of action.
What's on hope
in some order? Well, you and I have got really involved with Acorn.
That's true.
And it's good times, you know.
It's good times.
And I tried to join a communist party. It hasn't really panned out yet, but you know.
I've tried to join the same communist party.
Has it panned out yet?
Well, I think I've done enough of the entry program that I should get in contact with my mentor. Okay. And they said that they're restarting the educational program in like a week.
Maybe I should check
it
out.
So you should check it out.
But you know, I've gotten so into Acorn, to be honest. I hope it can, at some later date, perhaps it'll be part of some kind of coalition or whatever.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, it's not, you know, it's a worthwhile thing to do, no matter what, because we have been helping a few people locally already.
Yeah. It feels good to help people.
It does feel good.
And to, you know, feel like you're doing something useful rather than bashing your head against a brick wall.
Yeah, it feels like when I was involved in Labour, there was a group of us on the left who would always hang out and have a great time, but we're always having to deal with all of the sad sack weirdos and villains in the Labour Party. We're constantly crying, just banging our head against the infrastructure, trying to make something happen, screaming for our leaders to do something.
The Labour Party.
Well, it's a tire fire. But that's what's so good about Acorn, is that actually you can have a good time a lot of the time. Everyone's there to do stuff. You're actually all, you know, allies, and it's not factional war.
Yeah.
So it's quite good as a thing to partake in.
It's pretty nice.
If you don't want to get bummed out.
Would recommend. And also, you know, it's an important time to get involved because the suspension of evictions was just ended last week.
They just lifted the eviction ban on Sunday. Yeah. Yeah.
So, get involved.
Yeah, extremely good time to get involved.
Yeah. Well, that was a bit of a sour note to our point of hope.
But it's fun as well.
But it's fun as well.
And there's any UCU great unions out there?
Yeah, some students' unions are good.
Yeah, certainly. They have good people at them. Yeah.
Some of them.
They're doing their best.
Yeah.
So maybe we should wrap it up there.
Yeah.
And then we can come back. We can have a whole season of interviews.
Yeah.
We'll do research for episodes. Today was just like a kind of, we're coming in, we're taking off our coat, we're putting our hat up on the hat stand, and we're saying hello. And the listeners are like, where have you been? It was 20 years ago since you walked out the door and you didn't say goodbye. And we're like, we're back, and we got the milk.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, now it's
the
all
milk is kind
again.
Of rotten, but
yeah.
it's here.
It's here. But yeah, I thought we could close out with the song I've been listening to a lot.
Mm.
You've heard me singing it. The Future by
Leonard
Cohen.
Yes.
And he says in this song, give me back the Berlin Wall, give me Stalin and St. Paul. I've seen the future and brother, it is murder.
And he was right.
And he was right. I like the way he says brother. It reminds me of Hulk Hogan signing off all his tweets with brother HH.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, thanks for listening.
See you soon, listeners.
See you soon, brothers.
All the best.